Chapter 7. With whom am I speaking?
I am afraid that something bad has happened to me.
The Quran starts off no better than Muhammad himself. The Prophet's first revelation is a fiasco, but so as not to prejudice the historic beginnings of Islam, I shall let the first Muslims do it for me. Let's begin with what Allah has to say in his inaugural Quran address. This treasure isn't in the first surah. It isn't even inscribed in the first 50. It's buried near the end of the book.
Quran 96, verse 1. Read in the name of your Lord who created man out of clots of congealed blood. Read, for your Lord is the most generous. He who taught the use of the pen, that men might be taught that which he did not know.
That's the whole shebang. The moment of moments, the birth of Islam. An unnamed spirit, representing an unidentified entity, reveals itself to Muhammad, and this is all we get. Why would an all-knowing deity ask an illiterate man to read? Why does the spirit tell us that man was created from blood clots when it's not true? If this spirit
taught by the pen what men did not know,
where are those words? And why digress to an oral recital when written testimony is superior? It's not a very auspicious beginning for a religion capable of ensnaring a billion souls. There must be a cogent explanation. Yet the Quran makes no attempt to explain the nature of the meeting or the meaning of the message. There are but a handful of credible accounts of what happened that night. Let's turn to Al-Bukhari first. In his Book of Revelation, we find a hadith narrated by Aisha, Muhammad's child wife. She was the daughter of Abu Bakr, the man who became the first caliph. She had yet to be conceived when this event occurred.
Bukhari, the commencement of divine inspiration to Allah's messenger was in the form of dreams that came true like bright light. The prophet loved the seclusion of a cave in Hira. The angel came to him and asked him to read. The prophet replied, "I do not know how to read." The prophet added, "Then the angel caught me forcefully and pressed me so hard that I could not bear it any more. He released me and asked me to read. I replied, 'I do not know how to read.' Thereupon he caught me again and pressed me until I could not bear it any more. He asked me to read, but I replied, 'I do not know how to read, or what shall I read?' Thereupon he caught me for the third time and pressed me, 'Read in the name of your Lord who created man from a clot. Read! Your Lord is the most generous.' Then the apostle returned from that experience. The muscles between his neck and shoulders were trembling and his heart beating severely. He went to Khadija and cried, 'Cover me! Cover me!' She did, until his fear subsided. He said, 'What's wrong with me? I'm afraid that something bad has happened to me.' Khadija replied, 'Never! By Allah, Allah will never disgrace you.'"
Allah's name wasn't even mentioned in the first Quran surah. In fact, Muhammad's God remained an unnamed Lord throughout the first 17 Quran revelations. When the Lord was finally identified, his name was Ar-Rahman. It's curious, then, that this crucial Islamic hadith elected to contradict the Quran and call God Allah. Equally curious, why did Muhammad's wife, the pagan Khadija, swear by Allah when the god who bore that name was one of many rock idols? The answers are simple, different, and revealing. Aisha, the source of this hadith, didn't reveal it until after the prophet's death, long after Ar-Rahman's name had been incorporated into Allah's character. As for Khadija, Allah held the keys to something she and her husband coveted. The accounts of what happened this night are consistently inconsistent, and while that's bad as it relates to creation and patriarchs, those were events from another time, another people, another place, and another religion. Now Muslims are without excuse. Islam began in their midst, on their watch, and through their clan. We aren't dealing with things that occurred 2 to 4,000 years B.C. This is 610 A.D. Contradiction is now condemning, for it forces us to recognize that all Islamic scripture was preserved in like fashion, through oral transmission. If these recollections aren't reliable, nothing is. The second version of the first revelation is found in Tabari in Muslim.
Tabari. Aisha reported, solitude became dear to Muhammad, and he used to seclude himself in the cave of Hira, where he would engage in the Tananuth,
pagan religious rites performed in Ramadan that included fasting,
worship for a number of nights before returning to Khadija and getting provisions for a like period, till truth came upon him while he was in the cave. The first form of revelation was a true vision in sleep. He did not see any vision, but it came to him like the break of dawn. Muslim. The truth came unexpectedly and said, recite, to which he replied, I am not lettered. The apostle said, he took hold of me and pressed me till I was hard pressed. He let off of me and said, recite. I said, I am not lettered.
It continues on as before, until the Tabari Hadith picks up the nightmare with this line.
Tabari, Muhammad, you are the messenger.
What follows is convoluted, out of order, and conflicting.
The prophet said, I had been standing, but fell to my knees and crawled away, my shoulders trembling. I went to Khadija and said, wrap me up. When the terror had left me, he came to me and said, Muhammad, you are the messenger of Allah. Muhammad said, I had been thinking of hurling myself down from a mountain crag, but he appeared to me as I was thinking about this and said, I am Gabriel, and you are the messenger. Then he said, recite. I said, what shall I recite? He took me and pressed me 3 times. I told Khadija, I fear for my life. She said, rejoice, for Allah will never put you to shame.
While there are significant differences between these versions and insights worth examining, I want to focus on the most incriminating details. In the first version, an unnamed angel nearly pressed the life out of Muhammad. In the second, Gabriel is said to have kept Muhammad from jumping to his death. In the third, Gabriel is named again, but he does not appear until after Muhammad is comforted in Khadija's bed. Yet the Quran says nothing of Gabriel during the first 12 years of Muhammad's mission. We are not introduced until the first surah in Yathrib, which was the 91st chronologically. Since Muhammad alleges that Gabriel was the source of his godly revelation, these inconsistencies devastate his credibility. That said, I'd like to share the most esteemed version of Islam's initial revelation. It's a bit more colorful and comes courtesy of Ishaq's biography, compiled 100 years before the other sources.
Aisha said that when Allah desired to honor Muhammad, the first sign of prophethood was a vision in brightness of day shown to him in his sleep.
In other words, he was dreaming.
He liked nothing better than to be alone. When he left Mecca, there was no house in sight. Every stone and tree that passed by said, peace be unto you, Allah's apostle. Muhammad would turn around and see naught but trees and stones.
In other words, he was stoned.
He stayed seeing and hearing things as long as it pleased Allah. Then Gabriel came to him with the gift of Allah's grace,
the spiritual beating,
while he was on Hira in the month of Ramadan. The apostle would pray in seclusion on Hira every year for a month to practice the Tananuth, as was the custom of the Quraysh in the heathen days.
In other words, Muhammad was heathen, and the Islamic pillar requiring Ramadan fasting was pagan.
Tananuth is religious devotion
to pagan idols.
After praying in seclusion, he would walk around the Kaaba 7 times.
The centerpiece of the Hajj pillar is pagan as well.
Ishaq. The prophet set out to Hira with his family. When it was night, Gabriel brought him the command of Allah. He came to me, the apostle said, while I was sleeping, with a coverlet of brocade whereon was some writing, and said, read. I said, what shall I read? He pressed me so tightly that I was near death. Then he let me go and said, read.
This happens twice more, then.
When I thought I was nearly dead, I said, What shall I read, only to deliver myself from him, lest he should do the same thing to me again? He said, read in the name of your Lord, who created man of blood coagulated. Read, your generous Lord taught by the pen.
Then the illiterate man said,
so I read it, and he departed from me. I woke from my sleep. These words were written on my heart.
Eshak reports,
none of Allah's creatures was more hateful to me than an ecstatic poet or a man possessed. I thought, woe is me, I am a possessed poet.
The worst thing that can befall a man or woman is to be possessed by the devil. He or she loses all sense of decency. To his credit, Muhammad recognized what had happened. To his shame, he damned 3 billion souls along with his own.
Eshak, I will go to the top of the mountain and throw myself down that I may kill myself and be at rest.
There was no doubt in his mind. During the violent encounter with the spirit in the darkness of that cave, Muhammad had been possessed by the devil. He wanted to commit suicide, something that Satan could not allow. He had big plans for his prophet.
Eshak, so I climbed to the mountain to kill myself when I heard a voice saying, Muhammad, you are Allah's apostle. I raised my head to see who was speaking, and lo, I saw Gabriel in the form of a man with feet astride the horizon.
How, pray tell, would our terrified and possessed poet distinguish between Gabriel and Lucifer? And since the first revelation was sinister, that's a problem.
Bukhari, the prophet said, a good dream is from Allah, and a bad dream is from Satan.
By his own account, this was a bad dream.
Eshak, I stood gazing at him, and that distracted me from committing suicide. I couldn't move. Khadija sent her messengers in search of me, and they gained the high ground above Mecca. So I came to her and sat by her thigh. She said, O Abu al-Qasim, where have you been? I said, woe is me, I am possessed. She said, I take refuge in Allah. Allah would not treat you that way. This cannot be, my dear. Perhaps you did see something.
Khadija said, wheels of commerce turning in her head.
Yes, I did, I said.
Playing along?
I told her of what I had seen.
While I was asleep.
She said, rejoice, son of my uncle, and be of good cheer. Verily, by him in whose hand is Khadija's soul, I have hope that you will be the prophet to this people.
With that, the profitable prophet plan was born.
She gathered her garments and went to her cousin Waraka bin Nufal,
the Hanif,
who had become a Christian. He read the scriptures and learned from those who followed the Torah and the Gospels.
Tabati provides some additional insights.
He went to Khadija and said, I think I have gone mad. No, by Allah, she said, your Lord would never do that to you. You have never committed a wicked act. Khadija went to Waraka and told him what had happened. He said, if what you have said is true, your husband is a prophet. After this, Gabriel did not come to him for a while, and Khadija said, I think that your Lord must hate you.
This is followed by yet one more variant.
Tabari, in the beginning of the messenger's prophetic mission, he used to spend a month every year in religious retreat on Hira. This was part of the practice of the Tananuth, in which the Quraysh used to engage during the Jahiliyyah. Tananuth means self-justification.
That's intriguing. Muhammad practiced a Jahiliyyah ritual rite, an ignorant pre-Islamic form of pagan worship. Which more, the very definition of Tananuth, self-justification, became synonymous with the Prophet's personal agenda. So much for Muhammad's claim of being prevented from doing any pagan act by Allah. Islam began in the midst of a pagan ritual. The deeper we dig into Islam's initial salvo, the worse it gets. So hold your nose if you must, because it's time to poke around. We know that Muhammad was a recluse, a wannabe prophet, who preferred solitude to people. The fact that he spent so much time alone in caves, instead of at home being a parent and husband, or at work being productive, is troubling. Yes, he was being religious, but even that is problematic. As an idolater, he practiced the heathen Tananuth rituals, fasting, self-justification, and meditation during the pagan holy month of Ramadan. he disappeared into caves for spiritual awakening, calling out to a black stone named Allah, and he was ultimately possessed. The read versus recite debate is interesting in itself. Modern Muslims, in trying to resolve the obvious problem of why an all-knowing spirit would ask an illiterate man to read, say that the word really means recite. But that's worse. Why would Muhammad say he didn't know how to recite, especially when it was the thing that he was best at? And why would the spirit of Islam ask a man to recite if he taught by the pen? Even the word recite slash read is prickly. The original word is qara, from which Quran was derived. It was first used by the Syrian Christians to mean preach, not read. Even the Arabic words ma-a-kro can mean either I can't read or what shall I read? But that's still a problem, because Muhammad wasn't given a scroll to read. Since we have discussed Allah's ignominious inaugural address, let's move on to the Prophet's less than heroic response. According to every account, he was scared spitless. Imagine that. You've just invested the month of Ramadan hanging around in a cave for the express purpose of communing with the spirit world, and one comes and scares you to death. In the earliest versions, he is said to have been so distraught he wanted to commit suicide. The whole encounter not only sounds demonic, the wannabe prophet said he was possessed. The revelation over, the newly minted messenger slid down the barren slopes west of Mecca, scurried across 2 miles of desert dunes, and entered the narrow valley town, where he immediately coupled up to Mama, and make no mistake, his wife was the closest thing to a mother he'd ever known. Panicked and tormented, the 40-year-old Muhammad cried out to his 60-year-old wife,
"Cover me!"
crawling into the fetal position against her thigh. He thought he'd been molested by a jinn, possessed by a demonic spirit in the dark of night. He said,
"I do not know what has happened to me. I fear for myself." He poured out his mental confusion,
and according to Ibn Ishaq said,
"I'm afraid I'm going out of my mind and being possessed by an evil spirit."
Score another point for those who say Islam is satanic. In my opinion, what Khadija did next set the forces in motion that ultimately condemned 3 billion souls, enslaved over 1 billion women, and plunged the world into chaos. She founded Islam. Yes, Khadija was the founder of Islam. Muhammad was her first convert. In a twist of sadistic irony, the most liberated and prosperous woman in Islamic literature built the cage in which all Muslim women are trapped. Calming her husband and employee down, she said,
"Rejoice, cousin, and be of good cheer. You will be the prophet. Allah will not bring you to shame."
Muhammad thinks he's just gone mano a mano in a wrestling match with a demon, and Khadija says it isn't so.
"It can't be. Be happy. I swear by Allah that he shall never humiliate you. I hope that you may be the prophet of this community."
Allah was just one of 360 stones gathering dust in the Kaaba. Together with Hubble, Manaf, and the gang, they were the mustard on Mecca's hot dog. No Kaaba, no Hajj. No Hajj, no festival. No festival, no money. Khadija was a businesswoman, in business to make money, selling her wares to the pilgrims, who piled into Mecca each year to visit their gods. She wasn't going to let anyone foul that up. Not only did she tell her employee-slash-husband that he was wrong, that it was not a demon, she said that her god, the pagan lunar deity, the biggest and blackest stone in the Kaaba, would never allow him to be molested by an angry spirit. No way! Then, in anticipation of what was to come, she began her public relations campaign. She told her recluse husband that he was a swell guy, charitable, sociable, and trustworthy. He was the perfect candidate to be the social chairman of a fraternity. Bright and successful, Khadija was on a mission. She came up with a profitable profit plan. She had prospered in a man's world, but had no real power. In fact, she was embarrassed. Having been widowed twice, she had proposed marriage to Muhammad an employee half her age. It was scandalous. To gain permission, she had to get the patriarch of her family drunk at the betrothal feast. Once he was successfully intoxicated, Khadija was able to coerce the consent she required. The odd couple was married, but it was not all a bed of cactus flowers. Their sons died in infancy. It was a terrible stain in a culture that, like Islam, attributed misfortune to godly disdain. Khadija's husband was an absentee parent to the remaining daughters, and AWOL when it came to working in the family business. He was an illiterate recluse, with a penchant for lone vigils in barren, dusty, lightless caves, which, in a small town of perhaps 5,000, was gossip fodder. He was hardly making her look good. You just know the girls were talking behind her back. So to turn the tables on them, Khadija tells her husband that he's the prophet of his people, Allah's guy. As God's messenger, he is important, and so is she. The lucrative custodianship of the Kaaba, the even more lucrative administration of the Hajj, the religious tax, was Muhammad's birthright, she implied. But fate had dealt him a savage blow. Now, Khadija knew, opportunity was knocking. She and he could have it all, everything they coveted, prestige, power, money. All they had to do was convince the Meccans that Muhammad was Allah's messenger. Since Allah was just a rock, no one would ever be able to dispute their claim. What was Allah going to do? Roll over? Crumble? Actually speak?
No way. It can't be. Be happy. I swear by Allah that he shall never humiliate you.
Khadija even tells her hubby that he's perfect for the job. Truthful, generous with her money, and for a loner, he's caring and entertaining. But it must not have been enough. Prophet man just laid there, quivering. What little we have heard thus far makes no sense when attributed to divine revelation. However, it makes perfect sense when we view the Quran in the context of a self-aggrandizement scheme, the self-justification of Tahannuth. If I'm right, and Khadija was trying to proselytize Muhammad, recruit him into her profitable prophet plan, what do you suppose she'd do next? Get someone religious to validate her claim, perhaps? Yes, indeed. Let's return to the hadith.
Bukhari. Khadija then took Muhammad to Waraka bin Nawfal. He was the son of Khadija's uncle,
and the brother of a sorceress.
He was the only man in town who had embraced Christianity in the pre-Islamic days of ignorance. He used to write down the writing with Hebrew letters. He would write from the gospel in Hebrew as much as Allah wished him to write. He was very old and had lost his eyesight. Khadija told Waraka, "Listen to the story of your nephew, my cousin." Waraka asked, "Nephew, what have you seen?" Muhammad described whatever he had seen. Waraka said, "This is the same one who keeps the secrets whom Allah has sent to Moses. I wish I were young and could live up to the time when your people would expel you." Muhammad asked, "Will they drive me out?" Waraka said, "Yes, anyone who came with something similar to what you have brought was treated with hostility." A few days later, Waraka died, and the divine inspiration was paused for a long while.
Ishaq tells us that Khadija went alone to Waraka.
Ishaq, when she related to him what Muhammad had told her he had seen and heard, Waraka cried, "Holy, holy, if you have spoken the truth, Khadija."
And what are the chances of that?
"There has come unto him the Namus, the spirit who appeared long ago to Moses. Tell Muhammad to be of good cheer, for he is to be the prophet of his people." So Khadija returned to her husband and told him what Waraka had said. As a result, his fears were somewhat calmed.
Tabari's account is presented in Muhammad's voice.
"Then she took me to Waraka and said, 'Listen to your brother's son.' He questioned me, and I told him what had happened. He said, 'This is the Namus.'"
From the Greek word law.
which was sent down to Moses, son of Abraham.
The dialogue repeats that found in Bukhari until this line, spoken by Muhammad.
The first parts of the Quran to be revealed to me after Iqra were by the pen and that which they write. You are not a madman. Yours will be a reward unfailing, and you are of a great nature. You shall see, and they shall see.
Muhammad's quotation is an incomplete variant of the 68th surah. But the Islamic scholars who have reordered the Quran chronologically believe that the 68th was the 40th surah handed down, not the second. Montgomery Watt, the translator of this volume, agrees, saying the 68th surah was unlikely to be early, since it implies that Muhammad had been charged with being a madman, possessed by jinn. This error by Muhammad at the outset of his Quranic career is horrendous. It means that even he couldn't remember when his revelations were given to him. That aside, I have a bone to pick with Waraka. Moses met directly with Yahweh, not some cave-dwelling rascally spirit named Namus. Moses asked, "Whom should I tell the Israelites is sending me?" My Bible says that God answered him directly and said, "Yahweh," which means I am. In fact, the Bible never mentions Allah, a word which means oak tree in Hebrew. And Yahweh's name is repeated 7,000 times, something that would be hard to miss if old Waraka actually knew Hebrew. But what did Waraka know about this? It's irrational to think that someone would translate the Gospels, which were written in Greek, into Hebrew, a dead language at the time. Aramaic, maybe. Or Arabic, if it existed in written form in Mecca. But not Hebrew. Besides, Moses is chronicled in the Torah, not Gospels, so it was the wrong book. And Waraka was the wrong guy to be translating the written word. He was blind. But blind or not, the old man, a mere 72 hours from death, served Khadijah's purpose. She used him to convince her fellow Meccans that Allah had a messenger. Her man was the next Moses, a prophet to her people. So how does a new religion spring to life on such shaky ground? If the facts are so obviously fallacious, how could the revelation be truthful? What I'm going to say next may appear scandalous at first blush. I believe Muhammad murdered Waraka. The Hanif was the most revered holy man in Mecca. After Khadijah had used him, he became a liability, someone who could and would profess that Muhammad's claims were untrue. When you finish Prophet of Doom and discover how many men Muhammad assassinated for the same reason, I believe you'll share my view. Next we learned that even Khadijah was troubled by Muhammad's dark adventure into the spirit world.
Tabari and Ishaq. Cousin, can you tell me when this visitor comes to you? Muhammad replied, yes. She said, tell me then when he comes. Gabriel came to him as before, and Muhammad said, here is Gabriel, who has just come to me. She said, yes? Come, cousin, and sit by my left thigh. He came, and she said, can you see him? Yes. Move around and sit by my right thigh. He did so, and she said, can you see him? Yes. She said, sit in my lap. He did so, and she said, can you see him? He replied, yes. She was grieved and flung off her veil and disclosed her body while the apostle was sitting in her lap.
Alternate one says,
Khadijah put the messenger inside her shift next to her body.
Alternate two proclaims,
I heard that she made the apostle come inside her shift.
Both end with,
then she said, can you see him? No. At that she said, rejoice, cousin, by Allah, this spirit is an angel and not Satan.
The implication is that the mystery spirit was an angel, not a devil, because he was too modest to look upon an old woman's body. But angels don't lust, and pre-Islamic women didn't wear veils. Yet in fairness, Khadijah was a 60-year-old desert dweller. A peek under her shift might have frightened the devil. Khadijah wasn't the only one who couldn't see Muhammad's shy spirit.
Bukhari, the Prophet said, Aisha, this is Gabriel. He sends greetings and salutations to you. Aisha replied, salutations and greetings to him. Then, addressing the prophet, she said, "You see what I don't see."
And he would have been hard to miss.
Bukhari, the prophet informed us that he had seen Gabriel and he had 600 wings.
The identity of Muhammad's dark spirit aside, there was another nagging problem, radio silence. There were no visions, dreams, demonic encounters, or wrestling matches. Nothing for nearly 3 long years. The menacing cave critter was nowhere to be found. Every day, Muhammad went to visit the spirit at the Kaaba, but the mighty Allah couldn't even muster a simple howdy or read or whatever rocks are inclined to say when their pen pal stopped by for a visit. It was embarrassing. He was a messenger without a message. Anguished, Muhammad contemplated suicide a second time. So what do you think happened next? Right you are, Prophet Vision.
Muslim and Bukhari. While talking about the period of pause in revelation, the prophet said, "While I was walking, all of a sudden I heard a voice. I looked and saw the angel who had visited me at the cave sitting on a chair in the sky. I got scared of him and ran back home and said, 'Wrap me in blankets, Khadija.' And then Allah revealed the verses of the Quran to me. 'O Muhammad, the shrouded one, wrapped up in garments, arise and warn the people against the Lord's punishment, and abandon the idols.'"
This candidate for revelation number 2 is a divergent recital of Quran 74:1.
After this, the revelation started coming strongly, frequently, and regularly.
The second revelation is found in the 93rd surah, not the 74th. It speaks specifically of the multi-year hiatus in divine inspiration. How are we supposed to believe anything Islam's prophet says when he can't keep his own story straight? Further, there are 2 enwrapped surahs, not 1, and neither is consistent with Muhammad's recollection. Besides, if Gabriel were sitting on the floating chair, why did Muhammad run home? We're told that he was suicidal because Gabriel was nowhere to be found. He shows up and his messenger flees? No way. And if it were really Gabriel, why do we have to leave Mecca and endure 90 surahs before we're introduced to the alleged source of these recitals? The Quran's legitimacy is entirely dependent upon its source. Then it gets worse. We're asked to believe that Allah, who has been too busy being the top dog of the Kaaba to chat with our hero, finally tracked the panicked prophet down. He tells a grown man, hiding under the covers, that he wants him to go out and warn people. And why is Allah so angry? Why does he need to punish all the little blood clots? He and his prophet are just getting warmed up. We haven't even been introduced. If this is God speaking, why doesn't Muhammad know his name? Remember, all of the early surahs use the title Lord. And when the spirit finally gets around to introducing himself, he says that he is Ar-Rahman. Maybe we've got the story wrong. Let's check out another hadith, just to be sure.
Muslim and Tabari. I asked Abu Salama what was revealed from the first Quran. He said, "The shrouded one enveloped in the cloak." But I knew better and said, "Wasn't it recite?" Jabir said, "I am telling you what the messenger told me. He said, 'I stayed in the cave for 1 month, and when my stay was completed, I came down and went into the valley. Somebody called me. I looked, but I did not see anybody. I was again called, but saw nothing. I raised my head, and there on the throne in the atmosphere, he was sitting. I began to tremble because I was afraid of him.'" These were
Caliph
Uthman's words, but the correct version is, "I was terror-stricken by him. Then I came to Khadija, and they threw water on me, and Allah sent down this: 'You who are shrouded, arise and deliver a warning. Your Lord magnify, your clothes cleanse.'"
At this point, all we know for certain is that Muhammad was a pathological liar. He had a poor memory, and he was depressed and suicidal, and that he claimed to be demon-possessed. Madudi, one of the most famous Quran commentators, explains,
After this first revelation, no revelation came down to the prophet for quite some time. The long suspension was such a period of deep grief and distress for him that he started going early to the tops of the mountains to throw himself down from them. But whenever he stood on the edge of a peak, the angel Gabriel would appear and tell him that he was Allah's prophet. This would console him and restore his peace of mind.
As the author of an esteemed Quran commentary, we have elected to reveal his comments in the same voice as Islamic scriptures, to clearly distinguish orthodox Islamic thought from my own. The hadith upon which this embarrassing confession is found proves that Islam's lone prophet was suicidal.
Tabari, the inspiration ceased to come to the messenger for a while, and he was deeply grieved. He began to go to the tops of mountain crags in order to fling himself from them. But every time he reached the summit of a mountain, Gabriel appeared to him and said, "You are Allah's prophet." Thereupon his anxiety would subside and he would come back to himself. Muhammad explains, "I was walking one day when I saw the angel who used to meet me at Hira. I was terror-stricken by him."
If he was comforted by Gabriel every time he wanted to commit suicide, why did his image terrify him? Why didn't the spirit impart a message if he met with his messenger on these occasions? And why are none of these encounters mentioned in the Quran? Let's open our Qurans to the 73rd Surah and see what Islam's spirit had to say.
Quran 73, verse 1. O you who have been wrapped up in your garments, who said, "Cover me, cover me. I am afraid of the angel." Keep watch all night except a little, and recite the Quran as it ought to be recited, in slow, measured, rhythmic tones. Surely we will soon entrust you with our weighty word. Surely the night is the most devout way, when the soul is most receptive and the words most telling. During the day you already have a busy schedule, an occupation with ordinary business duties.
Muhammad's spirit friend wants him to spend the night reciting the Quran. Since 80 words have been revealed thus far, that's a pace of 8 words an hour. But that is trivial compared to nocturnal devotion. The Quran was revealed in darkness, and night is the best time to ponder its meaning. Satan is the prince of darkness, and evil loves the night. We have stumbled onto another clue.
Quran 73, verse 8. But keep in remembrance the name of your Lord, and devote yourself to him wholeheartedly.
How can one remember the name of a Lord who has not yet been named?
Lord of the East and West, there is no Illah but he. Take him, therefore, for your disposer of affairs, and bear patiently what they say, and avoid them with a becoming avoidance.
That would make Muhammad the only messenger who was told to avoid his audience. A hadith says,
Ishaq, now Muhammad did not want his secret to be divulged before he applied himself to the publication of his message.
In other words, he needed time to create enough of these rhyming surahs to make his claim seem believable.
Quran 73, verse 11. Leave me alone to deal with the rejectors, the possessors of ease and plenty. I respite them a little. We have heavy fetters with us to bind them, and a roaring furnace to burn them, and food that chokes, sticking in the throat, and a painful torment.
While we haven't been introduced, Muhammad's spirit seems all too familiar. The Bible speaks of the Lord of the Fire, of a spirit that chokes the life out of men, binding them to sin. Muhammad's Lord is the spitting image of Satan. Before we press on, I'd like to bring your attention to the fact that nothing religious has been revealed thus far. The Quran is but a paragraph long, and its prophet has been told to avoid discussing it. Therefore, Muhammad is being rejected, not his message. This rejection, preceding possessors of ease and plenty, tells us that the wannabe prophet is tormented by his relative poverty. Covetous of what belongs to others, his inward anguish turns sadistic. The heavy fetters, roaring furnace, and choking torments are a way of lashing out at those he envies. At this early juncture, there is no other plausible explanation. Either Muhammad was deeply disturbed, wanting to torture men without justification, or his deity was unjust and perverted. As such, the
enwrapped
surah unravels Islam's moral authority. Portions of the 93rd surah were revealed second, chronologically.
Ishaq. The revelation stopped for some time, so that the apostle was distressed and grieved. Then Gabriel brought him the morning, in which he swore that he had not forsaken him and did not hate him.
The following insight is from Maududi.
The surah's theme is to console the prophet and remove his anxiety, which had been caused by the suspension of revelation. By swearing an oath by the morning and night, he was reassured. Then he was given the good news that the hardships he was experiencing in the initial phase of his mission would not last long. Soon Allah would bless him so abundantly that he would be pleased.
This is nonsense. Muhammad hadn't suffered any hardships on account of his mission thus far, because there had been no mission. All that had happened was a bout in a cave with an angry spirit, a nonsensical revelation, some panic, Khadijah's scheme, a blind man's blessing, and a little boasting around town, but Muslims needing an excuse for the Prophet's morose and suicidal behavior were willing to contradict Allah's revelation to give their hero an alibi. Let's dive into the surah so you can see what I mean.
Quran 93, verse 1. I swear by the early hours of the day, and the night when it covers with darkness, your Lord hath not forsaken thee, nor doth he despiseth thee.
Whoa, time out. Why the King James 17th century English? Do you suppose the words thy, hath, forsaken, thee, and doth despiseth are being used in these translations to make the Quran seem biblical? Just speculation on my part, but for readability's sake, I'll endeavor from now on to make the Lord's words more intelligible. Let's move on. Now that we doth verily know that the Lord doth sweareth, but hath not forsaken, although it beeth a mystery why he doth despiseth thee not, and why he loveth the darkness. But here's a clue. Satan is the morning star, the prince of darkness.
Quran 93, verse 4. Surely what comes after is better for you than the present or that which has gone before. Soon will your Lord give you so much, you shall be well pleased. Did he not find you an orphan and protect you, and find you lost and perplexed and show you the way? Did he not find you poor and made you rich?
Times can't be so bad that God has to bribe prophets. He can't really think the blood clot revelation was direction. Muhammad could barely find his way home, and if the Lord had already enriched Muhammad, why is his present so bleak? Or better question, since Muhammad had the childhood from hell, how was he protected? Is God's memory failing, or is Muhammad's spirit endorsing Khadijah's profitable prophet plan? He found you poor and made you rich. This is a good place to give you my interpretation of the gospel according to Khadijah. Stick with me, kid, and I'll make this prophet gig profitable. I can't prove it, mind you, but it makes more sense than this coming from God. Having married money twice and climbed the social ladder of Mecca, Khadijah was in trouble. Her fortunes were dwindling, while her absentee husband employee sulked in caves. Having made a fortune selling trinkets to the Hajj pilgrims at the pagan fairs surrounding the Kaaba, Khadijah knew all about religious scams. So she had motive, means, and opportunity. What more, her behavior was consistent with my theory. According to Aisha's testimony in the Hadith and Ishaq's in the Sirah, Khadijah was the real founder of Islam. Muhammad believed that he had been possessed by a demon. He was scared to death. She converted him to Islam, usurping her nearly dead cousin's credibility. Remember what she said?
No, never, it can't be. Be happy, I swear by Allah that he shall never humiliate you. Truly, I hope you will be the prophet of this people. Allah will not bring you to shame.
Let's review the facts. The caravan business Khadija owed its prosperity to Allah's recently restored pagan rock shrine. It stood not more than 100 meters from where this conversation took place. Mecca provided one of the very few wells, shallow as it was, for caravans moving goods from the ports of Yemen to Syria. While that was good, no one becomes rich caring for folks passing through town. So the Kaaba became Mecca's meal ticket. Muhammad's great-great-great-grandfather, Qusay, had gained control over the idol temple and organized the annual pilgrimage to the shrine. He collected a tax from every Arab attendee. While a religious tax was a profitable idea and one that made its way into Islam, the series of economic fairs Qusay arranged surrounding the Hajj proved to be his most capitalistic venture. Papa Mutali, Muhammad's grandfather, the one who sacrificed camels to the Kaaba idols at a sorcerer's urging, ultimately gained control over the concession to feed and water the pilgrims. He became the recipient of the religious tax, something that made him even richer. As the Kaaba's custodian, he pocketed big bucks, charging Arab chiefs rent for housing their sacred stones. He charged them more for visitation rites, and still more for their god's care, feeding, watering, and dusting services. The combination served to make the merchants of Mecca rich, by Bedouin standards anyway. Khadija was a beneficiary, so she told Muhammad, "Better than being the Kaaba's custodian, you are Allah's prophet, and that's more prestigious and profitable than being a recluse, my dear." A hadith entitled
"Khadija the First to Believe"
contained these incriminating lines:
Muhammad was to tell them of his Lord's bounty to himself. Of the bounty of your Lord, let your discourse be.
This was followed by:
Thereupon the messenger began to proclaim Allah's bounty to himself.
Ishaq Sirah reports:
Khadija was the first to believe in Allah and his apostle. By her, Allah lightened the burden on his prophet. He never met with contradiction and charges of falsehood, but he was comforted by her when he went home. She strengthened him and belittled the opposition.
Khadija believed in Allah before Muhammad did, because Allah was her meal ticket. And while she conceived the prophet idea, she had to endure a great deal just to keep God's messenger going. His
contradictions
prompted
charges of falsehood.
We have already discovered these echoing throughout the hadith. So Khadija
belittled the opposition.
This made her the inspiration for the Quran's overwhelming propensity to condemn Muhammad's opponents, threatening them with doom. Testimony in support of the profitable prophet plan can be found throughout Tabari's history.
During the Jahiliya, I came to Mecca and stayed with Abbas bin Mutalib. The sun rose while I was looking at the Kaaba. A young man,
that would be Muhammad,
came up and gazed at the sky. He turned to face the Kaaba. Soon after, a woman,
Khadija,
and a youth,
Ali,
came and stood behind him. The young man bowed and the woman and youth bowed. Then the man stood erect, followed by the woman and the youth. The young man prostrated himself, and they did the same. Abbas asked, "Do you know what this is?" "No," I answered. "This is Khadija, my nephew's wife. He has told me his Lord has commanded them to do what you see them doing. Allah's oath, I do not know anyone on the face of the earth but these three who follow this religion." I asked Abbas, "What is this religion?" He answered, "This is Muhammad bin Abdallah, who claims that Allah has sent him as his messenger with this religion, and that the treasures of Crusos and Caesar will be given to him by conquest."
This is an incriminating confession. It is an admission of guilt, proof that Islam was created by a wannabe pirate. I'd like to linger on this hadith a moment. I'm surprised that the Islamic scriptures would confess to the profitable prophet plan so openly. This is the first explanation of the motivation behind Muhammad's religion. And we're told that it was conceived to steal treasure by way of conquest. While this is confirmed countless times in Medina, we're still in Mecca, just 3 partial surahs into the Quran, And Tabari's hadith does not stand alone. Ishaq reveals a similar tradition, only his is more direct.
When I was a merchant, I came to Mecca during the Hajj pilgrimage. While I was there, a man came out to pray and stood facing the Kaaba. Then a woman and a boy came out and stood praying with him. I asked, "What is their religion? It is something new to me." Abba said, "This is Muhammad, who alleges that Allah has sent him with it, so that the treasures of Crusos and Caesar will be opened to him. The woman is his wife, Khadija, who believes in him."
The original motivation for Islam was greed. The profitable prophet plan has been confirmed by the Hadith, Sirah, and Quran. A false prophet composed situational scriptures for money. However, the Khan got off to a rocky start. Muhammad impugned his credibility. Rome had long since been plundered, so the last Caesar had been sandals up for centuries. And you may be wondering why Muhammad would covet Crusos' treasure. I did some digging around and found that he was Khusu Parvez, a Persian king and contemporary of Muhammad. In 626 AD, adjusted for today's dollars, he had stashed away over $2 billion in silver and gold. His annual income exceeded $700 million. Relative to the others of his day, he was the richest man alive. In Bukhari, we find another confession of guilt.
The prophet said, "Khosra will be ruined, and there will be no Khosra after him, and Caesar will surely be ruined, and there will be no Caesar after him, and you will spend their treasures in Allah's cause."
Jihad. And?
Bukhari. The prophet said, "If you live long enough, the treasures of Khosra will be opened and taken as spoils. You will carry out handfuls of gold and silver."
Then?
Bukhari. "I have been given the keys of the treasure of the world by Allah."
Money was the motivation behind Islam. In this light, let's examine the remainder of the second revelation of the profitable prophet plan.
Quran 93, verse 9. "Therefore, treat not the orphan with harshness, or oppress him, nor repulse the beggar. As for him who asks, do not chide him. But as for the favor your Lord has now bestowed upon you, Muhammad, announce it."
This also sounds suspicious. Islam's first two religious covenants are specific to Muhammad. He was an orphan, treated with harshness. He was oppressed, probably molested, as we will learn later, and he had to beg. He was chided as a child and as a man. These things haunted him. It is why he had his God tell those who treated him so poorly that it wasn't nice. But he would get even, because his dark spirit was going to make him rich and them poor. Then, in a less-than-godly blunder, Muhammad's Lord tells his prophet to announce their business relationship before introducing himself, or telling us anything about his nature or purpose. He even contradicted himself. The 73rd surah told Muhammad to avoid such announcements. If you think I may be a little too cynical here, just wait. Each of the next 20 surahs served to confirm my theory, one already rife with confessions. Before we go to the Lord's fourth Quranic gift to Muhammad, let's look at how the prophet said these insights came to him. Once again, Aisha, the 50-year-old prophet's 6-year-old wife, is the source of Islamic enlightenment. She said,
Bukhari. "Allah's messenger, how is the divine inspiration revealed to you?" He replied, "Sometimes it is like the ringing of a bell. This form of inspiration is the hardest of all, and then this state passes off after I have grasped what is inspired. Sometimes the angel comes in the form of a man and talks to me, and I grasp whatever he says." Aisha added, "I saw the prophet being inspired and noticed the sweat dropping from his forehead on a very cold day as the inspiration was over."
Since the hadith claims Muhammad only saw Gabriel on two occasions, how did he come upon the remaining 112 surahs?
Bukhari, whoever tells you that Muhammad saw his Lord is a liar, and the prophet only saw Gabriel twice.
In Islam's creation account, we were told that Allah had given up on oral communication and wanted everything in writing with angelic witnesses. Now he turns to an illiterate man and communicates by means of a gong. The God of a billion people ought to be more capable than clanging bells, blood clots, and having to bribe a despondent messenger. Yet that's all we've got thus far. Perhaps things will turn around with the next series of revelations. Unfortunately, no one seems to know what came next. Muslims don't even know how the surahs were pieced together. Early and late revelations are jumbled haphazardly. So the best we can do is to attribute a collection of surahs to the formative period. The 96th surah is a great example. The first third represents the first verses revealed. The remainder was received years later, when the Prophet began to prostrate himself at the Kaaba. We're told that Abu Jahl, Muhammad's arch-rival and nemesis, taunted him. Madudi reports,
after his appointment to prophethood and before he started preaching Islam, Muhammad began performing the prostration prayer, facing Allah's house the way Allah taught him.
Surprisingly, this performance was never described in the Quran. Its absence is perplexing. Allah took time to give Muhammad permission to partake in incest, thievery, womanizing, the slave trade, and mass murder, but never bothered to explain the nature of the religious performance.
Watching the technique, the Quraysh assumed that he had adopted a new religion. The other people were watching it with curiosity, but Abu Jahl, in his arrogance and pride, threatened the Prophet and forbade him to worship in that way at the Kaaba.
Madudi, endeavoring to explain the 96th surah, brings us this tradition.
Does Muhammad set his face on the ground before you?
When they replied in the affirmative, he said,
by Lot and Uzzah, if I ever catch him in that act, I will set my foot on his neck and rub his face in the dust.
Since the Kaaba was called a mosque, or place of prostration in Arabic, way back in Qusay's day, Muhammad didn't invent the face-to-the-ground bowing.
When he saw the messenger in the prostration posture, he tried to set his foot on his neck, but suddenly he turned back as if in fright. Asked what was the matter, he said, there was a ditch of fire and a terrible apparition between me and Muhammad. On hearing this, the Prophet said, had he come near me, the angels,
would you believe demons,
would have smitten him and torn him to pieces.
This is intended to be another proof of Muhammad's calling, but it's lame. The notion that Muhammad's most annoying rival, after publicly threatening the Prophet, would admit to seeing a divine sign protecting him is ludicrous. If it occurred, he might run, he might apologize, he might become a Muslim, but Jahl would never confess to being foiled by the Prophet's deity, and then remain an adversary. Unless, of course, he saw the fire as a symbol of the devil's influence in the Prophet's proclamation. Other scriptures from Bukhari and Muslim report.
The Prophet was performing his prayer at the Kaaba. Abu Jahl passed and said, Muhammad, did I not forbid you to do this? And then he started to threaten him. In response, the Prophet rebuked him severely. Thereupon, Jahl said, on what strength do you rebuke me? By Allah, my followers in this valley exceed yours in number.
This time the scene was recast without the embarrassing reference to the pit of flames. But that hardly gets the revisionists out of the fire. It would be some time before Muhammad would reveal his God's name. And by their own admission, there were only 3 Muslims in a town of 5,000. With the hadith providing the necessary context, let's see what Muhammad's spirit friend had to say.
Quran 96, verse 15. Let him beware. If he,
Abu Jahl,
does not desist, we will seize him, smite his forehead, and drag him by the forelock, a lying, sinful forelock. Then let him call upon his henchmen for help and summon his council of comrades. We will call on the angels of punishment to deal with him, or we will call the guards of hell, or we too would summon braves of our army.
This scripture was so bizarre, I elected to give you 3 different translations of the killer angels, God calling them
tools of punishment, guards of hell, and an army of braves.
Sounds demonic. Further, the depiction of a spirit seizing a man, smiting a man, dragging a man, is consistent with Satan. It didn't take long for Islam to get nasty, or for Muhammad to reveal the source of his inspiration. The surah ends with,
Quran 96, verse 19. Nay, beware, do not obey him. Pay him no heed, but bow down in adoration and draw near.
So in this, the first surah revealed, the Quran's equivalent to, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth. Muhammad's unnamed Lord tells his lone prophet not to obey an unnamed boy. How profound. He threatens punishment and calls on an army of hell's angels to drag his victim off so that he can personally oversee his torture. Then he tells his messenger to approach a pagan rock shrine and bow down in adoration. This is some god. This is some book. This is some start. The 74th surah is similar to the last two revelations, so let's review it next.
Quran 74, verse 1. O you who are covered up in your cloak, arise and deliver your warning, and your Lord do magnify, while keeping your garments free from stain, and uncleanliness do shun, nor expect in giving any worldly gain. And for the sake of your Lord, be patient.
Once again, our hero is hiding under the covers. Yet his seizing, smiting, and dragging Lord wants him to deliver a warning. That's quite a picture. But so to pretty it up, the Lord, ever fascinated with meaningless details, tells Muhammad to dress for success, to keep his clothes clean. And he listened, according to Will Durant. In his Story of Civilization, he says, Muhammad was vain. He gave considerable time to his personal appearance, perfumed his body, painted his eyes, dyed his hair, and wore a ring inscribed, Muhammad, the Messenger of Allah. Later hadiths will confirm each of Durant's charges. Vanity aside, I find that the don't expect any worldly gain verse hilarious, considering that it followed Allah's promise to make Muhammad rich. We are only a few hundred words into the Quran, and we have another contradiction. While Muhammad's claims of divine inspiration are disputable, there is no dispute over his wealth. Islam made a prophet. The next verse continues a trend that may be the most demented ever conceived in religious genre. Paraphrased, God hates us and can't wait to introduce us to a hell he has made for our hospitality. While heaven and hell are concepts borrowed from Judeo-Christianity, Muhammad takes them well beyond Dante's Inferno.
Quran 74, verse 8. The trumpet shall sound a day of anguish for disbelievers. Let me alone to deal with the creature whom I created bare and alone. Leave me to deal with those I granted wealth and sons.
As diabolical as this sounds, this is Islam in a nutshell. We are told that anyone who doesn't believe Muhammad is destined to be punished by his God, up close and personal. The Islamic God's hands-on involvement with anguish is the antithesis of Judeo-Christianity, in which hell is defined as separation from God. In Islam, the dark spirit wants to be left alone to supervise the torture. The next time someone suggests that the gods of the Bible and Quran are the same, remind them of these verses. There are 1,000 deeds that could have been mentioned in this early surah, like love, not committing murder, telling the truth, being faithful in marriage, not coveting what belongs to others. But all we get is what irks the would-be prophet.
Quran 74, verse 15. These men are greedy and desire that I should give them even more. By no means, for they have offered a stubborn opposition to our signs and our revelations.
There have been no signs, and Muhammad has yet to share a single revelation. He's still hiding under the covers. So what we are getting here is a peek into the prophet's covetous and tormented soul. He's so insecure, so paranoid, he believes he's going to be rejected. Leaving this delusion, we return to sadistic.
Soon I will visit them with a mountain of calamities, imposing a fearful doom and a distressing punishment. Quran 74, verse 19. For these men thought and plotted, so woe to them! They shall be cursed for their plots.
While we have been exposed to a series of plots, this is the first in order of revelation. It is particularly troublesome because Muhammad's spirit is so eager to because Muhammad's spirit is so eager to curse man. He threatens before he teaches. With that, I'd like to propose another theory. There is a reason the Quran was assembled out of order. When it's realigned chronologically, its credibility evaporates.
Quran 74, verse 21. Again, woe to them! May they be cursed for how they plotted. They looked around, frowned, and scowled with displeasure. Then they turned back and were haughty with pride. They said, "This is nothing but magical enchantment, derived and narrated from others. This is nothing but the words of a mortal man."
In this passage, the Quran debuts one of its most repetitive themes, Muhammad and his message. Would be attacked for a host of reasons, including their lack of divine credibility, their satanic or demonic tone, and for their obvious plagiarism, stealing the script from prior sources. Those who recognized this, as most did during Muhammad's day, were cursed and doomed to be roasted by Islam's God. The surah continues with this twisted rant.
Quran 74, verse 26. Soon I will fling them into the burning hell fire. And what will explain what hellfire is? It permits nothing to endure, and nothing does it spare. It darkens and changes the color of man, burning the skin. It shrivels and scorches men.
Youch! Muhammad's spirit is getting a little hot under the collar. Sure, there's a hell. But this Satan wannabe is way too into the details. And as for stubborn opposition to...
our signs and our revelations.
He's kidding, right? Opposition to what? Blood clots? Reading, reciting, being nice to orphans? And what signs? There haven't been any. No miracles, no prophecies, not even any new material. So why the temper tantrum? This surah jumps back and forth, as does much of the Quran, from first person singular to plural. So the problem might be schizophrenia. I and our are routinely used in reference to Muhammad's demonic spirit. While this duplicity is irritating, there must be more to it than this. Islam is only beginning. Muhammad has just been called, and he is yet to preach. His God remains unnamed. So why visit creation with a mountain of calamities, impose a fearful doom, fling men into fires that darken the skin, scorching and shriveling? And what's up with God being bothered by people plotting against him? That's like me taking on the American military with a pea shooter. The Quran's mean-spirited outbursts make no sense in the context of a religious prophet. But if Khajiita was the inspiration behind Muhammad, it's another story. The story of a scheming profiteer.
Belittling the competition.
The merchants of Mecca chafed at the preposterous allegations of the self-appointed prophet because they controlled the religious scam and they didn't appreciate his claim to their property. But for those who have an appetite for hell talk, be of good cheer. The Lord provides.
Quran 74, verse 31. We have appointed 19 angels to be the wardens of the hell fire. We made a stumbling block for those who disbelieve, and we have fixed their number as a trial for unbelievers, in order that the people of the book may arrive with certainty, and that no doubts may be left for the people of the book, those in whose hearts is a disease.
According to the dark spirit of Islam, angels are hell's wardens, and he uses them as stumbling blocks to foil mankind. And while that's demented, it pales in comparison to claims that the people of the book, Christian and Jews, are diseased and that they will arrive in hell with confirmed reservations. During radio interviews, I am routinely called a bigot when I expose Islam. Yet I never speak unkindly of Muslims, only of the doctrine that drives so many to murder and mayhem. It's Islam that is unkind. The Quran isn't debating scripture, doctrines, or even deeds. It's condemning human beings. As such, the Islamic God is a hateful, intolerant racist, a bigot. The 31st verse of the 74th surah continues with this line.
And for those to whom the scripture book has been given, and the believers, there should be no doubt. The unbelievers may say, "What does the Lord intend by this?" The Lord will lead astray whomever he pleases, and he will guide whomever he pleases. And none can know the armies of your Lord except he, and this is no other than a warning to mankind.
This is confusing. Who should be in doubt, Muslims or infidels? The Quran wouldn't be a book for decades. The Hebrew Bible had been a book for nearly 2,000 years. The Gospels promise heaven to those who accept the Messiah as their Savior, no doubt. The Quran only promises paradise to murderers, martyrs in their parlance. All other Muslims remain in doubt until their scales are weighed. And as for being pleased to lead folks astray and having an army,
what does the Lord intend by this?
The lack of clarity may be intentional. Muhammad's deity admitted he toys with people. God playing with men's souls is embarrassing. Creating stumbling blocks and leading folks astray is demonic. Swearing by the moon, capital M, is incriminating. It reveals our Rahman's and Allah's origins.
Quran 74, verse 32. No, truly I swear by the moon as a witness, and by the darkness of night as it wanes.
Loving the darkness of night suggests the spirit of Islam is Lucifer. He was called the morning star, and his abode is hell.
And by the dawn as it is unveiled, surely hell is one of the greatest signs and gravest misfortunes, a warning to men.
The gravest misfortune, hell, was created expressly for him. With a deceiving and demonic spirit at the helm of the world's fastest growing religion, no wonder we're in such a mess today. The surah winds down with this.
To any of you that chooses to press forward or lag behind, know that every soul will be held in pledge for its deeds except the companions of the right hand. They will be in gardens of delight.
The first part of this verse is standard mainstream religion, at least non-Christian religion. A man will be judged by his deeds. The second part is senseless, desperate, even contradictory. Having collected fewer than a handful of followers, Muhammad was willing to offer a free pass to paradise to anyone who was willing to be one of his companions. But at what cost? The rest of the Quran is unambiguous. Islam is a religion of works, one in which Muslims are judged based upon the comparative weight of the good and bad things they have done during their life. This verse expressly contradicts that doctrine when it says that the right-handed companions aren't accountable. Both can't be true, which makes one a lie. In that salvation is at stake, this contradiction is catastrophic.
Quran 74, verse 40. They will question each other and ask the guilty, what led you into burning hell fire? They will say, we were not of those who prayed or fulfilled our devotional obligations, nor were we of those who fed the wretched. We used to wade in vain disputes. We used to deny the day of judgment, until death overtook us.
The conversation between those in the Garden of Delight and the inmates of the burning hellfire is told so that Muhammad's Lord can squeeze in a little religion in the midst of his tirade on retribution. With Islam, devotion is an obligation, not an expression of love. Further, men have been condemned for not doing something that has not yet been specified. But showing that he is a master of the obvious, the Lord adds prayer to his list of good things. There are now 5 do's in the Quran. Unspecified prayer and ritual have been added to orphan happiness, wretched beggar support, and cleanliness. And on the don't do list, we have vain disputes. The surah culminates with these bizarre verses.
Quran 74, verse 48. No intercession of any intercessors will avail them.
Whoever collected these surahs wants us to know that there is no Savior. Christ was just kidding about that salvation thing on the cross. However, by saying this, they injured their prophet's credibility, for he claimed to be an intercessor.
Verse 49. What is the matter with them that they turn away from admonitions as if they were frightened asses?
Asses indeed. 26 centuries earlier, Yahweh told us that Ishmael's offspring, a heritage Muslims claim, would be wild asses of men.
Verse 52. Each of them wants to be given scrolls of revelation spread out. No, by no means. They fear not the hereafter. Nay, this is an admonishment. Let them keep it in remembrance. but they will not heed unless the Lord wants them to. He is the fountain of fear. He is the font of mercy.
Stop the presses. Clang the bell. That's flat out amazing. Five revelations into Islam, and the Lord has just contradicted himself a third time. And this, like the others, is at the core of Muhammad's mission. Didn't the Islamic God teach the use of the pen so that he could teach men that which they did not know? Didn't he give scrolls to every Adam, Abraham, and Jesus? Now he says that when men ask for scrolls of revelation, they will be told, "No, by no means, no scrolls for you." Mecca, we have a problem. Oh, and I almost forgot. What do you think about a God who says,
"He is the fountain of fear. He is the font of mercy."
Beyond the schizophrenic duplicity, imagine spending eternity with a deity who calls himself the fountain of fear. For those who may be troubled by the biblical references to fear, fear not. The root of the Hebrew and Greek words used for fear mean revere when used in the context of our relationship with Yahweh. Moving on to the 94th surah, the next chronologically, Madhudi explains.
No sooner had Muhammad started preaching Islam than the same society which had esteemed him turned hostile. Their relatives and friends, clansmen and neighbors, who treated him with respect, began to shower him with abuse. No one in Mecca was prepared to listen to him. He was ridiculed and mocked in the streets, so the initial stage was very discouraging. That is why Surah 94 was sent down to console him.
Before we dive into the surah, I'd like to share a hadith from Ibn Ishaq to demonstrate how reluctant Muhammad was to discuss the relationship he had formed with his demonic spirit.
Ishaq, 3 years elapsed from the time that Muhammad concealed his state until Allah commanded him to publish his religion according to the information that has reached me. Proclaim what you have been ordered and turn away from the polytheists.
This is from Quran 15:94.
Warn your family, your nearest relations.
This is Quran 26:214.
When these words came down to the apostle, he said, "Allah has ordered me to warn my family, and the task is beyond my strength. When I make my message known to them, I will meet with great unpleasantness. So I have kept silent. But Gabriel,"
actually Lucifer,
"has told me that if I do not do as ordered, my Lord,"
Satan,
"will punish me."
This hadith is injurious to Islam. The surahs it references, 15 and 26, were not among the first 50 revealed, so the timing is impossible. Further, Khadija was the first Muslim and Ali was the third. Muhammad's only other family members were daughters, and in Islam they don't count. So what great unpleasantness was he afraid of? Moreover, imagine a revelation so feeble, the prophet has to be threatened to deliver it. Muslims deserve something better than this.
Quran 94, verse 1. Have we not opened up your chest and removed your burden, which left you hopeless?
Muhammad claimed that the Shahr al-Sadr occurred on three occasions. According to Islamic theory, his chest was cut open by the angels, his heart was removed, washed, and then reinserted.
Tabari, messenger, how did you first know with absolute certainty that you were a prophet? He replied, two angels came to me while I was somewhere in Mecca. One angel said, open his breast and take out his heart. He opened my chest and heart, removing the pollution of Satan and a clot of blood, and threw them away. Then one said, wash his breast as you would a receptacle. He summoned the Shekinah,
the Hebrew Shekinah, or God's presence,
which looked like the face of a white cat, and it was placed in my heart. Then one said, sew up his breast. So they sewed up my chest and placed the seal between my shoulders.
When none of this occurred, Islam doesn't escape the operation unscathed. If God wished to cleanse a man's spirit of sin, he wouldn't do open heart surgery.
Quran 94, verse 4. We have exalted your fame, raising high the esteem in which you,
Muhammad,
are held.
While I'm convinced that Islam was all about exalting Muhammad, this verse should be troubling for Muslims. First, theirs was the only egocentric prophet. Second, every Quranic verse revealed during this period says that Muhammad was ridiculed, mocked, and tormented by his neighbors. Either God hasn't been attentive and doesn't know what's going on, or he has a rather demented view of esteem. But Muslims miss the foolishness simply because the first surahs revealed are at the end of the book, and by the end of Muhammad's life, he had plundered his way to prosperity. The
opening up
surah ends saying,
Quran 94 verse 5, with every difficulty there is relief. Therefore, when you are set free from whatever you are doing, make your Lord your exclusive object.
In context, this is absurd. Muhammad had nothing else to do. In fact, he had made a career of ditching responsibility. As soon as he had become an adult, he married money and started hanging out in caves. The self-proclaimed prophet reluctantly began to recite dribs and drabs of the Quran publicly. But while the poetry may have sounded decent, the message was indecent. Collectively, almost universally, the people of Mecca became outraged. According to the Quran, Muhammad's friends called him a liar and a magician. They accused him of being possessed by devils. His kin called him an insane, plagiarizing poet. He was characterized as a sorcerer, a lunatic, a far-fetched forger, a fool, and a specious pretender. I was not the first to see Muhammad as a money-grubbing, self-aggrandizing, plagiarizing fraud. His own clan, his own family, his contemporaries saw right through his act.
The unbelievers said, he is a deceiving sorcerer, turning many gods into one deity. There must be a motive behind the Quran. It is surely fabrication. They laugh at the Quran and say, should we abandon our gods for the sake of an insane poet? Allah has not sent down anything. You are only speaking lies. When our clear revelations are read out to them, they say, this is nothing but a fabricated lie. This is nothing but pure sorcery. What sort of prophet is this? Why was no angel sent to him?
Then, from Surah 21,
they say, these are only confused dreams. He has invented them. Let him therefore bring a miracle to us, as did the earlier prophets.
Muhammad was called a fraud more than 100 times in the Quran. At least 20 times, his clan accused him of being the only prophet who couldn't do a miracle. In the 11th surah,
they say of the prophet, he has forged the Quran.
From the 10th,
we find you full of folly and a liar to boot.
Then in the 9th, we see the completed equation.
There are some among them who talk ill of the prophet. For those who offend Allah's apostle, there is a painful punishment. Have they not realized that anyone who opposes Allah and his prophet will abide in hell forever?
Before we turn the page on Muhammad's opening Quranic salvo, I'd like to share my perspective on Islam's beginnings. I believe the hadith in Quran. I believe Muhammad was running away from responsibility as they claim. Solitude became dear to him. He was searching for God in all the wrong places. As a result, he encountered a demon. It terrified him, just as it would have you or me. It possessed him. Panicked, he ran home and confessed. But his social climbing wife would have none of it. Khadija said that the demonic spirit was Allah. Ironically, she may have been right. She founded Islam by bequeathing the family business, the Kaaba Inc., Qusay's religious scam, to her recluse husband and employee. The Lord became Muhammad's ambition. The Quran became a tool, one used to claim his prize. God was created in Muhammad's image. He was tortured, illiterate, covetous, delusional, and demented.